Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast of the Financial Times. I'm Cardiff Garcia. I'm joined here in our New York studio, as I am every week, by Shannon Bond, co-host. Shannon, how are you?
I'm great, Cardiff. How are you?
I'm good, but I'm a little bit worried about something. Not all of our listeners are American, okay? So I wonder if our listeners abroad can get as excited about the fact that this Sunday is the Super Bowl as we are.
It depends on how many Broncos and Panthers fans there are out there in our listening audience.
I'm guessing there are some here in the U.S., okay? But we've got some good news for our listeners abroad, which is that the quality of media gets a lot better around this time of year.
It's true. So for all of the fretting in ad land, right, about ad blocking, cord cutting, Netflix, like all the ways everyone seems to be rejecting advertising, the one thing that marketers keep saying is, but think about the Super Bowl. People love the Super Bowl. Like, so many people watch the Super Bowl just for the ads.
It's true.
It's totally true. And it's become this sort of media circus around it. Many, many of the ads, we should say, so it's the most valuable real estate essentially in TV advertising. This year, CBS is charging.
Yeah, it's really expensive.
CBS is charging $5 million for a 30-second ad. These are sizable portions of some of these marketing budgets. It's not just like the big, big companies you think of, like Budweiser and Unilever, who advertise. It's also, there's always a couple like newcomers, a couple small companies who kind of go all in on the Super Bowl. And it becomes bigger and bigger every year, and earlier, it starts earlier and earlier every year. So everyone's putting their ads out now and doing these teaser campaigns. And
it's like the one part of the traditional media where things are getting more expensive rather than cheaper, right? Because like advertising for pretty much every other part of the media is falling apart, but yeah, not for the big football game every year.
Well, and anything related to live events, right? So the rights to air sports, those get more and more expensive every year. Broadcast rights keep going up. Advertising rates, are still pretty strong for other not quite as big as Super Bowl, but other live events like the Oscars, the Grammys. We've seen with political advertising, with the debates. Fox did really well in August in their first debate, partially because of the Trump effect. But yeah, no, you definitely see this huge dichotomy happening in media where the few places that can draw those kind of mass audiences, which are supposed to be the big strength of TV, can continue to command a really strong premium. But for everyone else, it's kind of dropping off at a rapid clip.
Speaking of the Trump effect, we got a bit of Trump on today's show.
We do.
So let's get right to it. On the show today, first up, a discussion of the Chinese economy and the wrenching rebalancing process that it's going through. We talked to Michael Pettis, who's here from Peking University, visiting us in our New York studios. And my colleague from Alphaville, Matt Klein, will join us as well. And then afterwards, Shannon and I talked to Matt Garahan, the FT's global media editor, about the entire landscape of conservative media in the U.S. and what a big impact it has on U.S. politics. And then finally, Amelia Mahasek is back to join us for the follow-up segment. And of course, stick around for our long-form recommendations. Lots of fun stuff today. Stick around. And in our first segment, we're going to be talking about the Chinese economy. Joining me for this segment, Matt Klein, my colleague on Alphaville. Matt, last week you were here talking to us about Japan and demographics. This week it's China. I'm actually convinced you don't really care about the U.S. economy anymore.
That's harsh, man. You should have seen my last couple of posts, but I'll let that slide.
Okay. And our special guest today is Michael Pettis, professor at Peking University. He blogs at mpettis.com. Michael, welcome to New York.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so you just published a 20,000-word blog post, a kind of magnum opus of like your views on China, right? Here's where I want to start. a lot of people look at the slowdown in the Chinese economy in the past year or so as part of the rebalancing process, shifting away from investments and exports and towards consumption. You don't necessarily disagree with that, but in your writing, you tend to emphasize the importance of debt and debt sustainability, and specifically the problem that debt continues to accelerate in China at a rate that's exceeding China's ability to service it. So why don't you walk us through your argument, starting with the sources of rising debt in China, where it comes from, who's owed, and who owes, and then tell us why it's such a big problem.
Well, ultimately, it's very hard to disentangle any of the debt from the banking system and from the government. So you can pretty much assume that much, if not most, of the debt is government debt ultimately. It's owed by the government, because if it's owed through the banking system, they're not going to let the banking system collapse. The reason that, there are two reasons why I worry a great deal about the debt. Part of it is historical and part of it is conceptual. And in my next book, I plan to explore the conceptual part as much as possible. I argue that once you have an excess amount of debt, which I define as straight financial distress definition, when the debt levels are high enough that there is uncertainty about how debt servicing costs will be allocated, then you have too much debt. And when you have too much debt, because of that uncertainty, all the stakeholders in the economy change their behaviors in ways that adversely affect the economy. And I want to explain this much more in my book. But the basic argument, which a lot of economists don't understand, but in finance theory is pretty well understood, is that when you have too much debt, that itself acts as a constraint on growth. But the historical part is something that more economists should be asking, and that is, when you look at the dozens and dozens of countries that have had too much debt, as I define it, in the last couple of hundred years, I can't find a single one that was able to reform the economy, improve productivity, and grow its way out of debt without implicitly or explicitly debt forgiveness. And the explicit debt forgiveness, of course, is you default and you get formal debt forgiveness. The implicit debt forgiveness is that you monetize it or you inflate it away, which means basically you force the household sector to pay for it. But I haven't found any exception. And that should at least puzzle us, because if it's the debt that prevents your ability to grow out of the debt, then it means that you cannot grow out of the debt and you must address the debt problem and you must explicitly allocate those debt servicing costs.
Okay. And in the context of China, the government has in the past few years made pledges to reform its supply side policies, right? But you distinguish between two kinds of supply side policies, those that are meant to raise productivity and efficiency, and those that do exactly what you just said, which is address the debt directly. So tell us a little bit about those reforms and what you think is the likely outcome.
This is going to be pretty controversial, because basically I'm going to argue, or I am arguing, that reforms aimed at improving productivity have never worked and they can't work. If you want to resolve this problem, you have to do two things. First of all, in order to slow the growth in debt, you've got to bring investment down, because investment is being misallocated more than ever. If you bring investment down, unemployment goes up, which nobody wants. So if you don't want unemployment to go up, you need another source of demand. And there are three sources of demand: investment, consumption, and net foreign investment and consumption.
Exports.
Net exports aren't going to work. China's too big. The world is in bad shape. So I think we can pretty much write that off. Investments. For a while, people were saying, well, if we sufficiently reform the financial sector, then the financial sector will stop misallocating capital. There are real uses of capital in China, and it'll begin to allocate capital correctly.
That it'll find better projects to invest in.
That there are good projects, and what we need to do is reform the financial sector so that it stops doing what it does and moves towards these new good projects. And I say, yeah, of course. If we do that, then we don't have a problem. But that's like saying, if I win the lottery ticket, I don't have to work anymore. It's true. But it's not very likely, and it's more than not very likely. I can't find a single case in history in which that kind of reform happened quickly enough. The only possible exception might be Chile at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s. But remember, they had a political collapse, an economic collapse, and a banking sector collapse before they did that. So I think that's very unlikely. I think we can write off investment. That's not going to replace bad investment as a source of demand. So we're left with consumption. That's the only way to do so. But why is consumption so low in China? I think by now we all know it's because household income is such a low share of GDP. So you've got to get household income up. And the only way you can really get household income up quickly is through explicit or implicit transfers from the government sector. So one way or the other, we have to do those transfers. The same thing applies to debt. The only way really to pay down debt, because it's all ultimately government debt, is to liquidate government assets and use that to pay down the debt. So we have the same answer to both problems, which, by the way, is not a coincidence. It's always how it happens. And the answer is to transfer government assets, to pay down debt, and to increase household wealth. But that's a political problem, and that's why it's so difficult to do. That's the vested interest problem.
Sure. How would you do that? What's the best way to avoid all those other problems you just mentioned while also redistributing wealth towards the household sector?
Well, any economist can tell you how. It's not very hard. You can privatize state-owned enterprises, use the money to fund a stronger social safety network or to give directly to the residents, to citizens. You can eliminate the hukou system, which immediately makes migrant workers wealthier. But now it makes the municipalities poorer, so they would have to fund that by selling off assets. You know, there are many, many ways you can do it. In March of last year, Shandong Province transferred state-owned enterprises, shares and SOEs, to the Shandong Pension Fund. That's not very efficient because I don't think the Shandong Pension Fund is terribly credible, but you can do that. There are a million ways to do it, but all of them involve opposition from those who control those assets.
From vested interests.
From the vested interests, yeah.
One last question before I let Matt get in here, because I want to tie what you're saying to the recent move in the currency, right? A lot of people thought that when China allowed the currency to depreciate recently, that part of the motivation was to reinvigorate its exports in order to cushion the slowdown in growth. Your explanation is a little bit different. It has to do with liquidity. Can you take us through that?
Well, you know, in this trip, I kept getting asked over and over again, what is their strategy and why aren't they articulating it more clearly? And I think it's a mistake to think that there is a strategy. It's really not clear what to do with the currency, because I think one of the goals is to stop the outflows. So how do you stop the outflows? If you don't let the currency depreciate and try to rebuild credibility, that's very expensive. That causes a significant reduction in reserves, and the reduction in reserves undermines credibility. So it's not clear that that's going to work. If you let the currency depreciate 5 or 6% a year, you're basically telling people what the cost of leaving their money in the country is. So it's hard to imagine that'll stop outflows. Maybe you can do a maxi deval and a peg, but I don't think that's credible any longer. Or maybe you can stop intervening altogether, but I don't think the currency goes down 10 or 15%. I think it overshoots. So it's not really clear that there is a strategy. If you really want to stop the outflows, you've got to have a big positive shock to confidence. And I suspect, since everybody is so afraid of debt, I suspect the only positive shock to confidence would be a really aggressive program to address the debt. For me, the way I see it, depreciating the currency doesn't really increase growth because we don't think unemployment is very high. Wage growth still seems reasonably strong. So if you depreciate the currency, you strengthen the tradable goods sector, but you probably weaken the services sector, the capital-intensive sector, by causing wages to be bid up. I would argue that depreciating the currency is a form of wealth transfer, and it's probably part of the political horse trading domestically, which makes it really hard to predict.
So actually, just following up on this, over the past, I guess, you know, 15, 20 years, private capital inflows into China were very positive. And the reversal has been extremely recent and is very vicious and violent. I'm curious if you give some sense of, you know, what changed and why suddenly the net flow reversed to the extent that it did.
Yeah, I kept hearing people ask me, isn't this just normal diversification? If you're rich, you've got to own assets in other countries. And if it hadn't been, as you described, so sudden, because really until 2014, there was a surplus on the capital account as well as a surplus on the current account. And then in 2014, we suddenly got a huge deficit on the capital account, which more or less matched the current account. And then last year, the deficit on the capital account was significantly greater, as you know. That doesn't strike me as diversification. That strikes me as something else. And as someone who started his career trading the defaulted and restructured debt in Latin America in the 1980s, it strikes me as capital flight. And there's anecdotal evidence that suggests the same thing. We can't really prove it, but the anecdotal evidence seems pretty strong.
Yes, I guess just following up, if you have any sense of why, you know, what might have prompted capital to leave in that way and in that time frame.
Well, if people are worried about the financial sector, if people are worried about debt, if people are worried about the political consequences of the anti-corruption campaign, all of those things should drive capital outflows. So it doesn't seem to me very irrational. It seems to me pretty normal.
I actually want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier, because one of the, I think, constant themes in your work is that finance theory is able to capture something a little bit more fundamental than economists and their models are often able to capture about the Chinese situation in particular, especially when economists use their equilibrium models. Right. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
I think this risks becoming a very long answer, but I think there's a difference between managing the asset side and managing the liability side. And when debt levels are low or when the balance sheet is not significantly distorted, most growth can be explained by the growth that comes out of the management of the asset side. But when debt levels are higher, when there are significant distortions, the liability side can actually cause growth to be higher than otherwise or lower than otherwise. And I think that that's not really included in much of the analyses that we've seen. You know, I would go so far as to say that any attempt to project Chinese growth rates that doesn't explicitly deal with the debt, you might as well just throw away, because it's gotten everything wrong about China so far. But more importantly, it's been wrong about every country with a lot of debt. They've never gotten that right. Debt is a significant constraint. And I think I have a reason to explain it. But even if my reason is wrong, it has to be more than coincidence that every single country with a debt problem has had ultimately to get some kind of debt forgiveness before it could grow.
I mean, following up on that, I mean, you also make a distinction, I think, is directly related to this about what we call economic activity or GDP and debt servicing capacity expansion or wealth creation. And I know you've written about this in the past, that in some countries these things are roughly analogous, such as in the US and China, they're clearly not. I mean, could you give some more explanation of what these differences are and how we can measure them?
Yeah, you know, I was reading Diana Coyle's book on GDP. I really recommend it. It's a quick read. You can read it on a single flight. And it you know, deals with a lot of these questions. But GDP measures economic activity. It doesn't measure wealth creation and it doesn't measure debt servicing capacity. We all know that. And what really matters, particularly when you're worried about debt, is not so much how much activity there is, but rather how much debt servicing capacity you're creating. You know, we could get 5%, 6% growth in the U.S. if we raise Chicago to the ground and rebuild it. That doesn't make us any richer, but it does increase temporarily economic activity. That kind of stuff isn't helpful at all. So when we have this big debate about whether Chinese GDP growth is really 6% or 5% or 4%, I'm not terribly interested in that debate, because that's a debate about economic activity, and I don't really care about that. What I care about is debt servicing capacity. How fast is that growing? And I don't have an answer. But I think most people agree that it's growing more slowly than GDP.
Matt solicited some questions from Twitter earlier. We're going to read to you a couple of those, okay, and hopefully you can field them as well.
In your view, does it help or harm both the world and China in particular if the Fed is trying to be more internationalist in the way it sets policy?
That's really tough. I think that the Fed should no longer be the global central banker. I don't think the U.S. economy is big enough that it can continue doing that. So I think the Fed should be focusing primarily on the U.S. economy. But having said that, it seems to me that the biggest problem in the world now is something we've seen many times before, and that is that there's significant income inequality. And we know what the impact of income inequality is. It forces up the savings rate, but the savings rate can only go up if productive investment goes up. It can only go up sustainably if productive investment goes up. And productive investment isn't going up. So that means something else has to bring the savings rate down, because ultimately they must balance. And there's two ways you can bring the savings rate down. One way is what we had before 2008, which is that soaring real estate and stock markets make the middle class feel rich. And so they go out on a consumption binge, a debt-fueled consumption binge. That's one way. But once you reach the limit, then you can't do that. So the only other way, and Keynes told us this in the 1930s, is unemployment goes up. So to me, that's the problem we're stuck with. We have a significant income inequality problem. Now, in the middle of the 19th century, we also did. There was a great deal of income inequality in England and very high savings rate. But there was a place for all of these savings to go productively, and that was the United States. It needed foreign savings, and it had plenty of room for productive investment. And I don't see what the equivalent is today. There are countries that need investment and have insufficient savings, but they're not credible, so they won't get the money. Maybe India will move into that position, but we'll see. There's plenty of necessary productive investment in places like the United States. Clearly, I took the train to Washington on Monday, and you know it's almost easier to go from Beijing to Shanghai by train than from New York to Washington, which is absurd. And so we have plenty of room for that, but for political reasons, we're not doing it. So I don't really see how, I don't see whether loose monetary policy or tight monetary policy, I don't see how it can possibly help.
One more.
What are the top five Chinese bands that you recommend for our listeners?
Are you kidding? It's like asking a mom who's her favorite son.
let's limit it to like top two or three then, if you don't mind.
No, that's even worse. our most successful band is clearly Carset Cards. They're the ones that have gotten the most critical acclaim. They played around the world, and you know, people like Sonic Youth love them, or ex-Sonic Youth. And then Chui Wan is a young band that's really blowing everybody away. So I love those two bands. But we got tons.
All right, final question. A lot of this discussion has essentially been about what might happen in China for the next 5 years or maybe the next decade or so. I saw a casual point made by an economist not long ago about what would happen after that, right? And he said that essentially, you know, the next decade might be difficult, right? As this rebalance happens, we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but it's probably not going to be pretty. But that in the long term, China has, at least throughout the last couple of decades, made fairly substantial investments in human capital. And so when it emerges from this process, it should have a fairly well-educated workforce, and that at least is a source of longer-term optimism. I guess I wanted to ask if you agree and to talk about that.
Sure. The real key is how they manage the rebalancing process, because historically, some countries have gone through the very, very difficult adjustments quite quickly, and then they start growing very quickly again. Other countries have not, and the classic case is probably Japan. You know, Japan, I think, used to be 17% of the world, and today I think it's 6 or 7% of the world, which I have trouble. I couldn't find any country that didn't do that or that did that in times of peace. During times of war, you can see that. But I think Japan's been pretty exceptional there, and that's what we don't want for China. I would argue that the way they manage the adjustment process is going to determine that, because the adjustment could be a 10, 20-year process, in which case a highly educated workforce today might not matter so much. So to me, that's really the key. And historically, that's always been the key. The countries that adjust quickly and successfully can continue growing, and the countries that don't never catch up.
Michael Pettis, professor at Peking University, blogs at mpettis.com. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
But before you go, Michael, what is your long-form recommendation for our listeners?
One of the great things about crises historically is that an awful lot of good books come out after a crisis. But I was really blown away by Adam Tooze's book on the First World War. I'm trying to remember the title of it, The Deluge. It's an absolutely brilliant book. It ties together not just the U.S. in Europe, which is they sort of star in almost every history of the First World War, but also Asia and Latin America. And it lays a wonderful foundation for understanding the Second World War and the post-war period. And I was really, really impressed by it.
Now, for all of you people who have complained and whined and moaned about the media over the years and how unfair they are to Republicans and how unfair that makes the whole process, and what are we going to do? You need to be studying Donald Trump. Care what do you think what he says is outrageous or wrong or whatever. That's the wrong way to look at this right now.
We still have people streaming across our border. Oh, that's worked out well. Oh, we still have a 500,000 people here on expired visas just in 2015. But don't worry, we have a Homeland Security Department that both the Bush started. Bush Bush thought this was a great idea to get everything together in one big department. And of course, Hillary Clinton and the Clintons supported it. So on big issues,
those are just some of the voices you'll hear on U.S. conservative talk radio these days, especially as we're heading into a very contentious presidential election. We are joined now by Matt Garahan, the global media editor for the Financial Times.
Hello.
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
And you did a big piece this weekend looking at the race as it's playing out, the presidential race as it's playing out in the conservative media sphere.
Yeah.
Maybe start off, tell us a little bit about the influence of conservative media in U.S. politics.
It's very different. And I don't know how many of our listeners from around the world are familiar with the U.S. media landscape. But, we have cable news channels like CNN and MSNBC and Fox News. Fox News in particular leans very heavily conservative, even though if you talk to them, they would deny vehemently that they are a conservative network.
And how would they refer to themselves, out of curiosity?
They take great umbrage at that term and say they are a straight news network that just happens to redress the balance that exists in media by having conservative voices. So Roger Ailes, the chairman of Fox News, would say that the mainstream media being the New York Times, CBS News, NBC, Washington Post, all of those other outlets, lean heavily liberal, and that all they're doing with pundits like Sean Hannity, Bill O'Reilly, and others is frame the news in a different way.
Like they're re-anchoring things. Everybody else is too left-wing. Fox is fair, but because everybody else is too left-wing, Fox News comes across as too conservative. But actually, their argument is that they are right down the middle.
Yes. And he would point to – there was a book that he authorized, I think, by Zev Chaffetz, came out last year, which lays this out pretty well. Ailes says you look at any other news – magazine show, news panel discussion, there's usually two or three liberals on the panel and one conservative. And he thinks that's been in place for decades. And this is really Fox is a counterweight to that kind of bias. So to take a step back, the Fox in the sort of conservative media landscape, Fox News reigns supreme. But as influential and as vocal really are talk radio. And in the heartland of America, talk radio AM stations are hugely popular, listened to by most people, and presenters like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, who doubles Fox News and has his own radio show, and Laura Ingraham and others have huge followings of conservative leaning people.
There's at least one way in which those two things differ: cable news and conservative talk radio, though, right? Mm. On cable news, it's true that I think most of us, despite what they say, would consider Fox News to be a conservative news channel. But you've got liberal news channels as well. You've got MSNBC. And then you have the sort of collection of liberal and conservative voices on things like CNN or other cable news channels that don't seem to have an ideological or a partisan bias. On talk radio, the really big voices are the conservatives, right? You don't have a liberal counterpart to a Rush Limbaugh, do you?
I think over the years, there are various attempts to create them. I mean, Air America, I think it was, and Shannon, remind me of the senator's name, who used to write for NBC, Al
Franken?
Franken was involved in that. Yeah, that's right, Al Franken. But they don't, they're just not as popular. And I guess the coastal elites, as the, as talk radio hosts would frame people who live on the coast, didn't pay much attention to liberal radio.
And arguably that's the role that NPR plays in the U.S. is a liberal leaning radio.
Although experience. They would deny that, obviously.
Again, they would say
as they would. Yeah.
But I think that certainly on the coast, like that would be what people would listen to on the radio.
Yeah.
And when they're looking for sort of news and commentary.
Yeah, good point. I guess I when I think of talk radio, I think of like these hosts with larger than life personalities who have shows that last 2 or 3 hours, right? Yeah. I mean, these aren't shows that you just sort of tune into to get little bits and bops of news, left-leaning or right-leaning or otherwise. I mean, these are hosts who just talk and talk and talk.
Yeah, and they rail against, the last 8 years, they've railed pretty consistently against the Obama administration, against the Obama agenda. They vary in their sort of out-there-ness, but they've been pretty consistent. And talk stations really blew up in the late 80s. I didn't get into this in the story, but it it's kind of interesting that Ronald Reagan had to renew, I think, a fairness doctrine, which on radio, which meant that if you're a radio station and you had political commentary, you had to give equal time to voices from both sides. And Reagan, the great free marketer, said, that's ridiculous and we don't need that. And there was this mushrooming and explosion after that, from the late 80s, of talk radio and the emergence of stars like Rush Limbaugh.
So your story is largely about how some of the conservative candidates, primarily Donald Trump, are playing a role on talk radio, and then also how the influence of talk radio is playing a role on the way the candidates frame their positions yeah. and the way they conduct themselves as they run for office. Talk about that kind of symbiotic relationship and how it's playing out in this election cycle.
Well, there's an interesting thing going on, and I'm going to kind of contradict something I said a minute ago about talk radio being hugely popular. It is. Talk radio is hugely popular, but in the last 5 or 6 years, audiences have started to go down. And by around 10 million people on average, I think from about 60 to 50 or 50 to 40, I'll have to check the story. And advertising revenues have gone down as hosts have been more controversial, said more controversial things. Advertisers no longer want to be associated with the likes of Rush Limbaugh if he's saying offensive things about particular groups of people. So the kind of cash cow is not what it was.
And that tracks a broader decline in radio as well.
Right. But the talk radio decline is greater than the decline in music stations. So that's created an interesting environment. And then along comes Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is ratings gold, right? Wherever he appears, people are tuning in. And talk stations have latched onto that. And some of the people I spoke to for the story said that they had jumped on the sort of Trump bandwagon for commercial reasons, maybe without even agreeing with his positions or agreeing with his stance on particular policies, that having him was good for business, but not necessarily good for the Republican Party.
So how, when you kind of look at the Republican Party, which certainly this year seems incredibly fractured, or sort of, you know, the difference you're seeing essentially between sort of the party proper and the base. I mean, how are we seeing like talk radio, the influence of talk radio play a role versus the role that Fox News plays, which often has been seen as more the voice, I think, of the establishment.
Yeah, well, Fox News is very firmly the voice of the establishment in this particular election because of the clash it had with Trump. But the talk radio has kind of become the populist voice. I mean, there's a fight going on within the Republican Party between, you know, the grassroots, the people, and the elites, and the establishment. And Fox News unwittingly has become framed, at least in this election, as being part of the establishment because of the feud it's got into with Trump and Trump's refusal last week to take part in the final pre-Iowa debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think when a lot of us think of talk radio, we associate it with a measure of ideological or conservative purity. But included in that are what I think a lot of people would consider to be the extreme positions of conservatism in the U.S., right? And so in the case of Trump, who has a kind of a mix of middle-of-the-road economic populist policies in some sense, right, and these more extreme views on immigration, and I think it's not totally unfair or left-wing of us to say he uses a lot of kind of disturbingly nativist rhetoric throughout this campaign. And so it seems like maybe what's happened is that Fox News was afraid to be tainted by what it didn't yet know was going to happen with Trump, right? It was sort of afraid to be tainted by an association with the unknown. Talk radio didn't have those misgivings. I guess I'm kind of curious to know how that split came about. Like, what do you guys think of how these two different genres, these two mediums, went about deciding, yes, it's fine to be associated with Trump? No, it's not fine to be associated with Trump. This to me is fascinating.
Well, his ratings gold for Fox too, right? And Fox have been, you know, like the other networks, have been all Trump all the time during this cycle. But when it came down to it, the sort of the quirk in the Trump campaign is, you know, the clash with Megyn Kelly, which was pretty well covered, and Fox stood behind her. Roger Ailes, who runs Fox, stood behind Megyn Kelly. Did not sort of accede to Trump's demands to have Kelly removed from the debate, the moderating stage, and took a stance again, you know, for Fox journalism, and said, we're going to be, you know, we're not going to be bossed around by you. We're going to, you know, but then he took it a step too far, playing into the drama, which was more ratings gold, by kind of getting into a fight with him and saying that, you know, mocking Trump with a statement last week and saying, oh, you know, I bet he's too scared to take part. I wonder how that would go down when dealing with Vladimir Putin or the Ayatollah, or, you know, which made for great drama and great spectacle. And then there was this kind of back and forth for 48 hours. Like, would he appear or wouldn't he appear?
Yeah, he didn't like it very much.
No, he didn't like it, but it was great for Fox ratings. The ratings for the final debate were pretty good.
I mean, I think this is it's all sort of another example of really how unlike any other political candidate Donald Trump is, because, you know, essentially, I mean, even other candidates who maybe, you know, would criticize Fox for not embracing some of the farther out there populist rhetoric, I mean, in some degree, they're reliant, right? They're reliant on being able to appear on Fox News and getting that attention. I mean, it feels like it's almost completely reversed with Trump, right? Mm. The media feels much more reliant on Trump than Trump is on the media,
right?
Because, I mean, he is a star in his own right. He has, you know, he can kind of go anywhere. You know, he can decide one day to be on Fox and not be on the next day, and he's not going to suffer for it in the way that a more traditional candidate, I think, would have a much harder time.
But there's a paradox, right? The paradox is Trump is great for ratings. Get him on air. He's terrific. The more he's on air, the less more moderate candidates, more establishment candidates get to appear. The worse that is for their campaigns. If you're a Republican in the media and you work at a talk station, or you're Roger Ailes, who was a very much a Republican, would love to see a Republican in the White House. There's a trade-off, because what's good for business isn't necessarily good for the party. In fact, it's bad for the party, because Trump is, you know, if Trump's still the lead candidate nationwide, he's polls very badly among non-Republican voters, or among all voters. So in a national poll, in a general election, he wouldn't win currently against a Bernie Sanders or a Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, there's, I guess, a kind of perennial tension for both talk radio and for Fox News about deciding how much Trump is the appropriate amount of Trump, right? Yeah. So on the one hand, we traditionally don't hold it against a candidate when he or she happens to be particularly charismatic or has great presence. That's just a part of what it means to be a good candidate and, in some senses, a good politician. At the same time, when a lot of the airtime is coming specifically because that candidate is known for saying outrageous things, mm-hmm. right, then you might have a little bit more of a conundrum, mm-hmm. right? So this is sort of, to me, an area where journalism overlaps with and often has a clash with media more generally, right? And I don't think it's really easy to resolve that tension. I don't know that it can be. I think it's maybe something we just have to live with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, an interesting point actually came up in when the New York Times did their primary endorsements last weekend ahead of Iowa. So they endorsed Hillary Clinton, and on the Republican side, they endorsed Kasich, which is probably a death knell for the rest of his campaign. But one of the points they made about Trump was that when he came in to meet with the editorial board, he basically says, like, you know, I'm really good at reading a crowd, and, you know, if I feel like I need to amp them up, then I just kind of sort of say something. Mm. You know, and the editors of the New York Times took that as, like, you know, saying, you know, framed it as, this is somebody who's sort of dangerous and is just going to go out there and say whatever it is to get attention. You know, and so I think you're seeing this, like, big divide, you know, within the media and the way, in terms of how to approach the coverage and how to, you know, how and when to call him out. Mm. And, you know, we see this in general, you know, what is the role of the media as a fact checker? And somebody like Trump really, really, you know, pushes those buttons. And, you know, for an organization like Fox or any conservative media hosts, you know, how far can you push before?
Well, I think that's the bigger point, that conservative media as a business that has its own struggles, and we talked about talk radio ratings going down. Conservative media is aimed at the base of the Republican Party, right? There doesn't really have any liberal listeners or liberal Fox is a very small proportion of liberal viewers, but you can make a case for saying that conservative media is bad for the Republican Party because it amplifies these populist voices like Trump. And these extreme positions, which are great theater and great television and great radio, but alienating for the people you need to win an election. Yeah. And that's the crunch of what I was trying to get at in the story. And someone actually told me, and I can't name them because they didn't want to go on the record, but, you know, he said that a lot of these talk stations, they don't agree with Trump. They get him on air. But it's good business, and he doesn't think that they care about not being a Republican Party not being in power, because it's better for them business-wise, to be part of the bitter opposition, as he called it.
Well, this is all fascinating. We're going to put a link to Matt's article in the show notes on Alphaville. But Matt, before we let you go, what is your long-form recommendation for our listeners?
My long-form recommendation, it's a bit of a leap from what we've just been talking about, but my favorite podcast, and I've been religiously listening to,
other than this one,
obviously, is Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode's Film Review Show, which is a BBC radio podcast. It's a 2 to 3 hour weekly look at movies and interviews and the rest, but it's really two old guys arguing, and they call it wittertainment because they witter and bicker. And it's highly amusing, and I recommend it to everybody.
Excellent.
Your own version of talk radio.
It's basically me and talk radio, yeah.
Matt Garahan, global media editor for the FT. Thanks, man.
Thank you very much.
And after a week off, Amelia Mahasek is back for the follow-up segment. Amelia, what did you think of last week's episode?
I thought it was long for a short-term discussion. We had, I've forgotten his name now, Mark Mobison?
Michael Mobison.
Yes. My apologies
yes,
to
that's
Michael.
Okay. The episode did run about an hour long. That is longer than our usual Alpha Chat episode.
No, I was just struck by the contradiction in Mr. Short-term's long answers. But anyway, right. No, it was really interesting. I'm a long-term kind of girl.
Yeah.
So I did find all of his thoughts quite challenging.
Let's define this. Yeah. We're talking about the conversation with Michael Mobison is about the trend towards short-termism in the actions taken by companies and investors. When you say that you're a long-term kind of person, you're saying you find this to be somewhat disturbing and you wish they'd move away from it. Michael offered some ideas for why this was happening, and it wasn't necessarily due to short-termism, but rather some structural and cyclical changes in the economy. And you're saying you're not sure you agree with him.
The bit I don't agree with is that he was suggesting that there's nothing wrong with short-termism, that maybe there are some benefits to it. And as someone we at the FT have been having a pensions discussion internally. And so as someone who's interested in long-term pensions, I think, you know, a long-term approach is to be encouraged rather than a short-term approach. You know, you want to know that obviously capital growth is important, but you want some capital preservation also if you're going to be waiting to 60, 65 over a 40-year time period. So, and it seems to me that a lot of people in investment management have very much shorter time frames. They're only in the industry for 5 or 10 years. You know, you're lucky if you can find someone who's been in it for several decades and seen several cycles. You know, we've almost had a single cycle for such a long time now that I find a sort of, you know, the optimistic view that there is some benefits to short-termism interesting, but in an overarching way, I prefer someone with a long-term view who was going to look after my money. The other thing that struck me in the discussion was that it generally seems we're talking about companies with a lot of cash piles that they don't quite know what to do with it. So they engage in short-term share price boosting activity like buybacks or maintaining dividends by borrowing money, which also seems bonkers to me. But I wonder about the lack of imagination in our corporate world about what to do with cash.
Sure. Well, here's where I might push back a bit, right? It's one thing to cite a lack of imagination. It's quite another thing to see a company be imaginatively wasteful, right? Because you wouldn't like it if a company decided to spend its excess cash on really kind of boneheaded investments or on things that are outright plutocratic, like I think I mentioned last week, a suite of corporate planes for its executives, right? I mean, that's the kind of investment I don't think any of us would get
behind. There's a long way between, no, of course, and that's just bad management and all round bad management, not even a failure of imagination. There's a long way between that, buying corporate jets, and actually thinking strategically about your business and what would improve it beyond just buying the next business that happens to be alongside or, you know, making the corporate suite more comfortable. And I wonder whether that some of that comes back to that you have companies where a chief executive himself or herself really, is there for 3 years or 5 years at the most. You know, you struggle to see chief executives who've been in the job for a decade. So perhaps there's, which of course also has some of its issues when management gets entrenched, but perhaps there's something in that there is no long-term thinking inside the company. So there is no incentive for them to think beyond their stock option package or even to be more thoughtful about what's good for their employees in a decade or what sort of, you know, contribution are they making to the world. There's none of that kind of thought that goes into the spending of the capital, it seems to me. And so then, in fact, they become in a circular way victims of shareholder activism. You know, you just become your own worst enemy, it seems to me.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the salient points. One of the reasons I really enjoyed having Michael on here, though, is because he lays out a lot of the nuances that I think are often missed in discussions of short-termism, one of which is that you can't ignore the circumstances, the wider macroeconomic circumstances in which it takes place. If you have a perpetually struggling economy, one that's stuck in one of these kind of stagnationist themes that we often discuss here, then it becomes a problem of executives thinking, well, God, if I invest in a new factory, if I hire more people, and it turns out that nobody wants to buy our stuff because the economy's so weak, I'm going to look like an idiot and I'm going to get fired. Now, within that context, there are still things they can do that are better ideas than borrowing money to boost share buybacks. And I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But at the same time, I think it's impossible to ignore the context. And yet it very often is ignored in kind of pundit stories or commentary that you find in the media. I think it's really important to bring that into the conversation. I thought he did that pretty well.
Yeah, indeed. I agree totally.
Amelia, before we let you go, what is your long form recommendation for our listeners?
My long form choices were completely blown out of the water by Jessica Jones, which you guys both recommended off air. And I feel like I've spent all of my 13 hours of spare time in the last 2 weeks watching.
You binged it.
I binge watched Jessica Jones. She's great, but as Shannon has said, she makes bad choices.
I have to admit I haven't actually finished it. I'm only a couple episodes from the end, but I've gotten really impatient with her lack of planning ability.
So we should explain it's the Marvel cartoons based, but not cartoon like
right,
series, which
on
is
Netflix.
Full of strong women, actually. That's quite
definitely
an interesting thing about it, even though they make bad choices.
Amelia Mahasek, always a pleasure, and we will see you back here next week.
Thank you, Carter and Shannon.
Shannon, before we close it out, we have not yet given our own long-form recommendations. What is yours?
I'm recommending a column by our colleague Sarah O'Connor, who's over in London. It is called Equal Pay for Millennials is a Boost for Equal Parenting. And then she basically makes the argument looking at some of the gender pay gap data, including Claudia Golden's research, which we've talked about here before, saying that for younger workers, you are starting to see that gap narrow, which is good news for a lot of reasons. But she's then saying, because of that, this should be a spur to companies to rethink their parental leave policies. And you know, as we're seeing, particularly with younger families, people wanting to distribute sort of childcare and sort of family life responsibilities more equally between partners in a relationship, our workplace policy should reflect this. So it's a good read. I recommend it.
Sounds great.
What about you?
My recommendation is Little Rice, Smartphones, Xiaomi, and the Chinese Dream. It's by Clay Shirky. It's a story of Xiaomi. By some accounts, the most successful startup ever. It's a Chinese company that makes smartphones, and yet I'd never even heard of it until I read Clay's book. It's a fascinating book and one that says a lot about where China's headed in the next 5 or 10 years.
Sounds great.
Shannon, I forgot how to close out a show, so I'm just going to leave it to you from now on.
All right, listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear what you thought of the show and send us your questions and comments. You can give us a call at 917-551-5012 or send an email to alphachat@ft.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm at Shannon Parai, ShannonPareil, and Cardiff is at Cardiff Garcia.
China might be on the rise, but we don't have to worry about North American competitiveness so long as the Canadian Amy Keene is based right here in New York. And the reign of conservative talk radio, on the other hand, should be worried, because once her ascent begins, it's over for everybody else. Thanks so much for everything, Amy. And thanks to our listeners. We'll see you next week for another edition of Alpha Chat.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.